What happens when a member of your Democratic Party wanders off message?
I believe there should be consequences. At the same time, we need for him to remain in our caucus. And the question is to find a balance, a sense of balance here that reflects our disappointment, in some cases profound disappointment, with really his criticism of Senator Obama.
Senator Joe Lieberman, Democrat turned independent, turned friend of Republican presidential candidate John McCain. Today, he learns his fate. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's November 18th, Tuesday. Catherine Lanfer is in for John Hockenberry. Good morning, Catherine.
Hey, good morning, Adora. Of course, that was Senator Tom Carper, Democrat from Delaware, talking about the fate of Senator Lieberman. And along with looking at that, we're also going to be looking at the lame duck Congress that convenes this week, the potential candidates for the Obama cabinet, and the Mexican smuggling wars that are crossing the border into Arizona. We're also going to talk about a looming ecological disaster out west. Plus, can a movie save Australian tourism? Those stories coming up, but first, these headlines.
Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson and Fed Chair Ben Bernanke head to Capitol Hill again this morning to testify before the House Financial Services Committee. They'll face tough questions about why they ditched the original strategy of buying up bad assets in favor of injecting $250 billion directly into banks.
And over in the Senate, the heads of GM, Ford, and Chrysler will make their case for a $25 billion loan to the Senate Banking Committee. They'll say they desperately need the help to keep the doors open, but it'll be a tough audience with those key Republicans. Here's Arizona Senator John Kyle on the Senate floor yesterday.
They've got to change the way that they're doing business in order to, warrant asking taxpayers for anything.
But Democrats, such as Maryland's Barbara Mikulski, say the aid will directly help people.
The 30,000 American dealerships in this country are at risk of losing 37,000 jobs. We can't let this happen. We can't let the American automobile industry implode.
The big three automakers will be joined by the head of the United Auto Workers today, and a vote is expected later this week.
Ford is the latest U.S. automaker to sell off a prized asset to help it stay afloat. It's slashing its stake in Mazda by nearly two-thirds. California is asking the Bush administration to declare Southern California a federal disaster site. That's after three wildfires burned through nearly 1,000 homes. Only one of the fires is fully contained. Oil prices lingered near $55 a barrel Tuesday in Asian trading. The Dow and the S&P were both down a little more than 2.5% yesterday. The Dow closed at 82.73, the S&P at 850. The government's $700 billion financial bailout tops the agenda, as it's done, Catherine, for many days, right?
Right, absolutely. And, of course, we've got the big three automakers pleading for a $25 billion loan. We want to hear what you think now that all of this is coming to a head. With all this money, what does Congress need to fix right now? Who really needs that bailout? Call us with your ideas at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I'm Catherine Lanfer in for John Hockenberry today. It's day two of Congress's lame duck session. Republicans and Democrats are gearing up for the first skirmishes in what promises to be quite the battle to remake the U.S. economy. So here are two questions. Are we going to bail out the big three automakers? And, oh, by the way, what's going to happen to Senator Joe Lieberman? Todd Zwillick is here. He's a reporter for PRI's Capitol News Connection, and he is joining us from Capitol Hill this morning. Hey, Todd, let's talk economy before politics.
Yes.
What's going to happen with the auto bailout?
Well, if you're an executive at one of the big three, you're probably not feeling great about it at this point. And the main reason for that is the 60-vote threshold in the Senate. Keep in mind, this is still the 110th Congress, not the 111th. So all of those gains that Democrats have made in the election, they haven't taken effect yet. Those new senators don't have a vote on the floor yet. So it's still 51-49 in the Senate, and 51 is not enough to get you to 60, obviously. And there are a lot of Republicans, and many of them took to the floor yesterday, who are not in favor of $25 billion or anything approaching it for the auto industry. We'll see what happens in hearings today, but without convincing a lot of Republicans, and even a couple of Democrats who've thrown a little bit of cold water on this. Without that, they're not going to get that in this 110th Congress.
Todd, what's the fundamental resistance to bailing out the auto industry? Everyone's got an opinion about the auto industry. Obviously, this is a very sensitive time in the economy. But what's the fundamental reason for not acting right now?
Well, I think you heard the crux of it in Senator Kyle's remarks in the audio that you played, which is basically $25 billion now without fundamental changes to the way these companies are doing business, their union contracts, the billions they spend on health care and pensions. Without fundamentally changing that, it's throwing good money after bad.
But why not demand those changes then? Give the money in exchange. I think, as Barack Obama indicated yesterday, that it couldn't be a blank check without some kind of conditions.
Well, I think then you get into the weeds of what those conditions actually look like and what a lot of Republicans want. First of all, philosophically, this is the same argument that was made with the bigger bailout of the financial industry. A lot of Republicans philosophically believe that businesses that are failing should be allowed to fail. And they've had quite enough of this bailout of industries. It goes against their principles. So that's point one. And then point two, another thing that Kyle said yesterday is that's what Chapter 11 is for, Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Let them go into Chapter 11, let them restructure, let them slim down, let them let go whom they need to let go, change those contracts, and then we can talk about supporting them, but not before.
What discussion are you hearing, though, about the fact that in some ways this is much more about not only the jobs at the automakers, but at the suppliers and the ripple effect as it goes on and on and on?
Well, of course, and you hear that discussion a lot, and that's the argument on the Democratic side, and many Republicans acknowledge that as well. You hear that argument being made strongly by the Michigan delegation and by delegations with assembly plants, parts plants in their states. So this is the tug of war that's going on. And part of the dynamic, of course, is that this Congress is leaving soon and a new administration is coming soon.
So I was just going to say, how much of this is time is of the essence? I mean, how much of this is we only have a few days of this lame duck session, and how much of it is the fact, what if they don't get the help this week? Then what happens?
Well, if they don't get the help this week, then it's wait and see. GM... Some executives from GM have said, we might not be here in January when you guys come back. Or if we do, we'll be further damaged. It will be even more expensive to save this industry then. So cheaper to do something now than to do something in January or February. If they don't manage to do something this week, it'll be wait and see. And I would be surprised if you don't see the big three come back in January as soon as there's a new Congress and try to ask again.
Before we get to politics, let's look at the other side of the bailout, and that would be the overall $700 billion financial bailout package. What kind of action do you think we're going to see on that this week with the lame duck session?
Well, the Fed chairman and Hank Paulson, the Treasury secretary, were up here last night, and they're up here again this morning in the House Financial Services Committee. So the question now is close to about $290 billion has already been spent. You know, they have the $700 total, and it comes in here's the math. It comes in $350 billion blocks. So they're getting close to the end of the first $350 billion. To get the next $350 billion, the administration has to ask Congress. And they're getting to that point where you start to say, will Paulson ask for the next slice, or will he kick it to his successor in the Obama administration? Paulson has said so far, and I think told the Wall Street Journal, that he doesn't want to ask for that money. He wants to hold it in reserve to get more punch from it. But if events unfold and volatility keeps being what it is on the stock market, he may have to ask for it. Now, in the rules, If he asks for it and Congress isn't around, they may have to reconvene yet again to approve it, or they could to approve it or to block it. Or they could stay away altogether and the administration would get their money automatically. I think you'll probably hear some of those dynamics come up this morning in Barney Frank's committee, whether or not Hank Paulson intends to ask for the money. If he does, what are you going to do with it? Because last time, you know, for this first slice, you sort of changed strategy midstream there, and now you're taking a completely different direction. Will he ask for the authority to use the next $350 billion or exit?
Before he's going to ask for that, before he's going to ask for that money, Todd, I think Barney Franks, the chairman of the Financial Services Committee, we spoke with him last week, and he made it abundantly clear that he's going to be asking some questions about why the banks are not relending the money. If they are getting these billion-dollar checks from the Treasury, why is that not seen in a turnaround on the other side of it in the hands of consumers, whether you're talking about companies or individuals? And there's some question as to whether or not that money is actually being lent out.
Yeah, and he's and Mr. Frank has had that concern since this plan was even passed. I remember, you know, a couple of months ago, well, I guess it was about 6 weeks ago now, before the bailout was even finalized, he was going around saying, we're going to be bird-dogging this plan. We're going to be watching it like a hawk, if I can use another bird metaphor, to make sure that the money gets used as it's intended. And it wasn't very long afterward and before Mr. Frank called hearings even before the adjournment to call Bank of America and some of the lenders onto the carpet to make sure they're lending the money the way he was led to believe they should, or whether the way that he wants them to. He apparently still thinks that it's not going the way he wants to. So he'll be raising those questions today. And you can bet in the new Congress, this plan's going to be around. We're not going to be out of the woods once Senator Obama becomes President Obama. So these hearings will continue, there's no doubt.
All right, Todd. I want us to quickly go over to what I think of as the marital counseling portion of the lame duck session. Let's hear this from Senator Tom Carper, a Democrat from Delaware, once again talking about Joe Lieberman.
Members will be able to say how they feel in their hearts to his face. He'll have the opportunity to speak to all of us from his heart. And somewhere at the end of that, we hope to find a balance that reflects our disappointment, our profound disappointment with his behavior as it pertains to Barack, and an opportunity to try to make sure that he stays in our caucus.
You know, Todd, they're not mad. They're just disappointed. So what is going to happen with Senator Lieberman on the Hill?
Well, he's going to face is it quite a jury? He's going to face a group of his peers today in the Democratic caucus. This is the classic behind wooden closed doors meeting, secret ballot. Lieberman faces his colleagues to answer for what Tom Carper was talking about, his behavior. His behavior, of course, not only supporting John McCain in the election, but speaking at the Republican National Convention, and not only speaking at the convention, but saying a couple of negative things about Barack Obama. And in the collegial world of the Senate, that is a no-no. A lot of them are very, very upset about it, and they want consequences. They want bad behavior to be punished. And that looks like it's going to be determined later on this morning.
Todd, what do you think the choices are? What are the options?
Well, okay, so you've got several. Option one is Lieberman could be kicked out of the caucus entirely. You no longer get to meet with us Democrats. We want you out of the club. Now, you heard Tom Carper say they don't want that to happen, and that's because of pragmatism. They want every vote they can get, and whether or not you are mad at him for supporting John McCain, Lieberman usually votes with the Democrats, so they want his vote. He has a committee chairmanship. That's the Homeland Security Committee and government oversight. He could be stripped of that. Now, Lieberman has suggested, it is said, nobody knows exactly the back and forth between he and Harry Reid. It has been suggested that Lieberman has said, if you push me too far, if you take away my chairmanship, I will just jump and go with the Republicans myself. He's not backing into this. Lieberman has been in the Senate a long time, and he made the choice to do this. So they could take away his committee chairmanships. Third, he has subcommittee chairmanships. He has armed services. He has an environmental committee.
Okay, Todd, we're going to have to
take that.
We're going to have to stop it there. Todd Zwillig.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. The government's financial bailout plan is topic number one on Capitol Hill today. The big three automakers are pleading for a $25 billion loan, and the folks on Capitol Hill, legislators, politicians, want to know what the Treasury government has been doing with the bailout money, where it's going, who's getting it, and whether or not they're passing the money on in the form of, say, loans to consumers. Who most needs a bailout? We'd like to hear your thoughts at 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Now we're going to move on to the election. Catherine Lanfer is in for John Hockenberry today, so she's going to join me in this election day, 2 weeks later, discussion.
Oh, have you heard all the conversation about who's going to be in the cabinet?
There certainly has been. President-elect Barack Obama has been hard at work. He's met with his former Republican rival, John McCain, yesterday. The two men pledged to launch a new era of reform targeting government waste and the Capitol's bitter partisanship. But as Catherine said, the big question is who is going to be in the Obama administration? And for some thoughts on that, we turn now to Lynn Sweet, who is the Washington bureau chief of the Chicago Sun-Times. Welcome, Lynn.
Why, good morning. And Catherine, how are you?
I'm okay, Lynn. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you.
One thing that President-elect Obama said yesterday that caught a lot of people's attention was he said the national press is tame compared to the local press. Was he talking about you, Lynn?
No, I was in Washington. But he was talking about what I think is the far more aggressive Chicago press corps. I mean this, if you bring up a question that may be funny, but in a very serious way, the Chicago press corps has always been harder on President-elect Obama than the national press, partly because they knew him, weren't particularly starstruck, and weren't afraid just to shout some questions. That's what happened yesterday in general, but in particular, it's just been more of a give and take, and less of a and Chicago press had always just been interested probably in some hard news questions. Obama's used to dealing with a press corps that has often very different agendas, so he gets very different types. He has the process gone very different types of questions.
So having followed him, how would you describe this process of the transition team and some of the candidates perhaps they're looking at for various positions in his administration?
Well, I think the way that the transition is operating so far is entirely consistent with how he has run the campaign, and that is just calm and deliberate, with the exception of the Hillary Clinton potential appointment, fairly leak-free and deliberate. He is in no hurry. He knows he has to get this done. He doesn't feel a need to pop out a name before it's time. When the roast is cooked, it will come out of the oven.
But you did mention there was an exception there.
Yes.
This has been a campaign and now a transition group and soon to be an administration. The campaign was really known for not having any leaks. In fact, people joked, at least among journalists, that it was no drama Obama. Does it surprise you then that there was this leak, or do you think that it was on purpose and that there was some very intentional actions taking place there?
Well, what actually happened is that there was a situation that the Obama people couldn't control, and they just hate when that happens, when something gets out of their control. And I don't know exactly how the news got out. It was a great scoop for Andrea Mitchell of NBC News, but one thing that did happen is that Hillary Clinton had to get on a commercial flight to come to Chicago. So that alone could have gotten the ball rolling, since she is the most recognized person and one of the most recognized people in the United States. That could have gotten the ball rolling, that people then, you know, hit the phones knowing that she was coming to Chicago on a late afternoon flight. Maybe that's how the ball got rolling. I don't know. So
I was going to say, for a lot of people were speculating that, in fact, it was a trial balloon.
Could be. It's not a bad one, given that there's so much out there that you have to think through in appointing Senator Clinton, because you do have to deal with President Clinton, And particularly in the job of Secretary of State, the former president has built a whole global foundation dealing with international issues, mm-hmm. travels extensively, and one of the other issues is gets money probably from foreign sources to help fund the foundation. All that had to be digested and thought about by the transition team and by President-elect Obama, who, by the way, is with Vice President-elect Joe Biden in Chicago today with no public schedule, so maybe they're thinking about all this very closely. There's a lot of vetting to be done.
Okay, very quickly. I know James Carville says that in an election you stab your enemies, but during a transition you stab your friends. Who is most likely, do you think, to be disappointed when this cabinet is assembled?
Well, I think somebody who's a very partisan Democrat who is going to be disappointed, who did not understand that Obama does not intend that Obama is going to form a working coalition and put people in it that give him what he wants to get the votes needed when he needs them. So if you think that because President-elect Obama is the first president in 8 years that you're going to have all Democrats, all highly partisan people, you may be disappointed, or people with a very specific personal agenda that they're identified with, I would be, then you may be disappointed.
Lynn, last question, and we have about 20 seconds.
I'll be quick.
Valerie Jarrett is someone that is well-known in Chicago, but not necessarily as well-known nationally. She is a very close confidant of the Obamas, and she has been there from day one of this presidential campaign. And now she's in the middle of the transition. What can you tell us about her?
Businesswoman. She is the CEO of a big real estate company in Chicago, a veteran of years and years in Chicago City Hall, different jobs there. She used to run the city's transit agency called the CTA. And here is one interesting note. The man that hired her in Chicago City Hall, a man by the name of Judd Minor, went back to private practice. Years later, would go on to hire a young Harvard lawyer by the name of Barack Obama.
Small world there in Chicago. Lynn Sweet, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Lynn Sweet, Washington Bureau Chief for the Chicago Sun-Times. And now Mark Garrison is here, and he's got some headlines for us.
Thank you. It's 28 minutes after the hour. Today is Judgment Day for Joe Lieberman. Democratic senators vote on whether the independent can keep his chairmanship of the Homeland Security Committee. Lieberman left the Democratic Party after losing in a primary. He's been serving in the Senate as a member of a party of one. He calls himself an independent Democrat. Some Democrats want to strip him of his chairmanship as punishment for supporting John McCain for president. Despite White House criticism, automakers are appealing to Congress for a new package of loans paid from the $700 billion bailout package. Under the Senate bill, the government would loan money at 5% interest in exchange for a limited stake in GM, Ford, and Chrysler. The bill faces a tough fight. Yahoo is going to be under new management. CEO Jerry Yang will step down as soon as his replacement is found. The board of directors is thought to be considering Yahoo president Susan Decker for the position. Microsoft says they have no new interest in buying Yahoo after a previous takeover bid failed this spring. The number of hungry children in America shot up more than 50% in a year. The Ag Department reports that almost 700,000 children went hungry in the U.S. even before the economic downturn.
All right. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. The government's $700 billion financial bailout is going to be discussed in a big way on Capitol Hill today. The big three automakers are pleading for $25 billion in loans, and it's all coming to a head. But is it money well spent? If you had all that money, what would you tell Congress to do with it right now? Should homeowners get the money, the auto industry? Who most needs a bailout? Give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Catherine Landfer is in for John Hockenberry today. Good morning, Catherine.
Hey, Adora. All of this talk about the economy and politics, It's let us lose sight of some other things going on. Did you know that North America is facing one of its worst ecological disasters in recorded history? How's that, huh?
Pretty
Wake
intense.
You up a little? Yeah. The mountain pine beetle. This is a bug that is native to the region, is killing millions of acres of pine forests. Warmer winters, the way humans use the land, have all allowed the appetite of this beetle to go unchecked. Now, we've got with us today Jim Robbins. He is a journalist who wrote a piece for today's Science Times and today's New York Times about this mountain pine beetle infestation. Jim, first of all, can you talk about where in North America this is happening? What swath of the continent are we looking at?
Well, it's happening virtually from the southern Rockies all the way up to British Columbia and the northern Rockies through Colorado, Wyoming, and Montana, where I live. And it's hit in varying degrees in different places. And in the United States, Colorado is probably the worst state hit. Virtually, in a few years, virtually all of the high-altitude mountain lodgepole pine will be gone. And in Canada, British Columbia has probably been hit the hardest of all.
You know, it's sort of hard to wrap your mind around these numbers. The largest known insect infestation in the history of North America? Give me something that helps me get a sense of the scale.
Well, if you stand on a mountaintop in Colorado, you can look in every direction virtually in some places and see dead trees. I mean, it is everywhere. I live in Montana. I can stand on my front porch and look out and see probably a third of the trees across the valley dead and red on the mountainside. When they die, they turn from green to red, and it's a pretty striking color difference between a dead tree and a live tree, and it's very sobering.
Wow. All right. And this beetle, tell me about this beetle. What does it look like? What's the biology? Why is it hungry?
It's small and black in its adult stage. It's about the tip of your finger. It fit on the tip of your little finger. And it flies to a tree. It burrows in through the bark, and it lays eggs. And then when this rice grain-sized larva hatches, it burrows into the cambium, which is what it eats, and the cambium is that thin sheet of tissue between the bark and the wood part of the tree. And what that does is it cuts the nutrients off that the tree takes up from the ground and sends up to the crown. And so essentially it cuts the lifeline off that the tree has for feeding itself. And then those grubs hatch, and then they fly onto other trees. So it becomes this kind of exponential progress as they grow to adulthood and then fly off to other trees. And you can see year after year, you see one tree, then you see 10, and then you see 100. And so it's this steady growth into the forest, and the trees turn red.
And this steady growth has essentially led to some campgrounds being closed, some ski resorts, lumber yards losing money. What's the effort to do something about these beetles?
It's very difficult. I mean, it's really hard to salvage this wood because it's after it's killed by the beetle, it's very light and it's hard to use structurally. It gets a blue stain that the bugs inject into it to stop the sap from rising, and that stain makes the wood worthless. Now, some furniture makers are using that blue stain as kind of an enhanced value for their product, but really it's a tough sell for 2x4s and those kinds of things.
Jim, how do you kill the beetles?
Well, you don't. Nature has to kill the beetles. It has to get really cold. It has to get 25, 30, 35 below zero for a few weeks in order for these beetles to die. And so that hasn't happened since the 1980s out here. And so what we have to do is hope for cold weather and hope that nature does the job, because there's just too many. It's too big an area for humans to make a difference.
And what have humans done to make this possible? We were talking in the introduction about how part of this is because of human activity.
Well, the big thing is climate change. We've so warmed the planet that we don't get these cold weathers anymore, and so this beetle can spread far beyond its normal range. It's spreading all over the West. And the other thing we've done is suppressed fires. Now, fires would come along every 7 to 10 years and clean out a lot of the forest and reduce the number of trees. Well, what's happened is humans have stopped fighting fires over the last, or excuse me, have fought fires over the last 100 years. And what that's done is given the beetle more of a foothold, more trees to eat, and it's led to what they call a decadent forest, which makes the beetle more at home.
All right. Jim Robbins, I want to thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Well, that's Jim Robbins. He is the author of a piece on pine beetles in today's Science Times and the New York Times. And Mark Garrison is in to give us the latest news. He's sitting in for Femi. Okay, Mark?
Thank you. 22 minutes before the hour. Hank Paulson and Ben Bernanke are headed to Capitol Hill this morning. They'll face tough questions about the bailout plan, specifically the recent decision to switch from buying up bad assets to investing directly in banks as a way to ease lending. The Navy says a giant Saudi oil tanker seized by pirates in the Indian Ocean is nearing the coast of Somalia. The Sirius Star is the biggest ship ever hijacked. It's carrying more than 2 million barrels of oil, and there are more than 20 crew members on board. The Israeli military has moved into the southern Gaza Strip, drawing fire from Palestinian militants. Israel and Hamas have been trading fire for the last 2 weeks. This after several months of relative quiet. The June 19th truce is due to expire next month. A fire official says one of three Southern California wildfires was human-caused, either by accident or by arson. The wildfires have burned about 1,000 homes and apartments in recent days. All three are being investigated. And the Wall Street Journal reports that clothing chain Stephen Barry's is going out of business. The low-priced retail chain has nearly 300 stores across the country. It gained national attention with fashion lines from celebrities such as Sarah Jessica Parker. Some 5,000 employees could lose jobs. And right now, the space shuttle Endeavour is up in space, and they're doing, you know, again, these are America's best. These are people who have achieved in the military, in engineering, science, and things like that. So let's just hear from Holly Riding. She's the flight director, about what exactly they're doing.
We're going to be moving our nitrogen tank assembly from external stowage platform number 3 over to the payload bay.
Yeah, so that's kind of like the space equivalent of moving something from the attic into the garage. And it does get a little bit more exciting after that, though, because it's, quote, being described today as a tedious cleaning and lube job. They're going to be scraping metal grit from a joint and greasing it. Now, again, it all sounds a little dull, and, you know, why did we go through space to do that? But it is actually pretty important because there's a problem with one of the wings where the solar cell can't turn enough towards actually facing the sun and getting power. So it does sound like just, like, you know, housework and chores and things like that.
Like,
but they got to face the sun if the thing can't turn.
Dental work in space.
Well, yeah.
Cleaning the grit off.
But zero gravity. I mean, you know, it makes it more interesting.
Yeah. All right. Thanks a lot, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. Today in Australia, there's great hope, Catherine, that Nicole Kidman and Hugh Jackman will be enough to lure in tourists. At least their latest movie, titled Australia, will so enthrall viewers, they hope, they will want to see the country for themselves. It's a romantic adventure set in World War II. Joining us now is a BBC correspondent, Nick Bryant. He's there in Sydney, where the film is set to make its premiere today. In fact, I think it did just several hours ago. Welcome, Nick.
It did indeed. It did premiere just a few hours ago. I was rubbing shoulders with Nicole Kidman in the rain of Sydney. It's summer here, but it was a rainy night for the
launch. So did her forehead move, Nick? That's all I want to know.
Well, a lot of people did think, like Sharon Osbourne, it did look like the plasma screen of a flat-screen television. But no, let's be a bit more generous than that. No, she looked good. And, of course, it's not so long ago that she had a baby. So a lot of people were remarking how trim she looked and how she fitted into a very short dress and looked very, very taut and very trim.
Let's talk about the movie. So what was the response to this movie and what are the hopes exactly?
Well, huge hopes. They're hoping it'll replicate what's called the Crocodile Dundee effect. There used to be a very simple way of promoting Australia. You just ring up Paul Hogan, the star of Crocodile Dundee, and you'd let him unleash his larrikin charm. And this had a huge effect in the 1980s. He started a Come and Say Good Day global advertising campaign before Crocodile Dundee, but Crocodile Dundee really made it take off. And within about 4 years, visitor numbers had doubled from the States. Now, Australian tourism could do with a shot in the arm like that right now. It's been hit by a whole string of bad luck and events that are outside of its control. 9/11 persuaded a lot of people not to fly, for instance. There was a SARS outbreak. They've been hit more recently by people wondering whether it's environmentally correct to go to such a long-haul destination. And now, of course, the global downturn. Last month, visitor numbers dropped by 7.5%.
Sure.
So the Australian Tourism Ministry is really looking at this as a feature-length advertisement, and it hopes it will replicate the Crocodile Dundee effect.
It's just hard to imagine Crocodile Dundee and Nicole Kidman and Hugh Jackman. And this is a story about a noblewoman on a cattle drive in Australia during World War II. What else do you know about the story? They don't seem to be too much like the fun-loving Crocodile Dundee movies.
Yeah, it doesn't really go for the kind of chirpy, bawdy humor that we saw in Crocodile Dundee. And it's really three stories in one. I mean, one is this romance between Hugh Jackman, who plays this cattle drover, a rough-hewn Aussie cattle drover, and Nicole Kidman, who plays this British aristocrat who travels to Australia after she's learned that she's inherited some land. There's a second story as well. It concerns the stolen generations. These were Aboriginal children taken away from their children, put in government settlements. A huge controversy in Australia over the past 100 years or so. So it deals with that as well. And the Japanese attack on Darwin, that's in the Northern Territory in Australia, an attack which took place during World War II. So there are these three stories that are taking place at the same time that are embroidered together.
Right.
And the director's Baz Luhrmann of Moulin Rouge fame. A lot of people are suggesting the film lasts too long, that he tried to do too much. It's the most expensive movie that's ever been made on Australian soil. He's Australia's creative genius in the cinema front. But there are some people who are saying, Baz, it was just too long.
Too long. That's the word from Nick Bryant, BBC correspondent, who's in Sydney reporting to us about the new movie called Australia. Nice music, Dylan. Thanks.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, November 18th. Mark Arison has joined us with the latest headlines of the morning.
Thank you. Coming up on 12 minutes before the hour, European markets have dropped about 1.5%. Stock markets in Japan and Hong Kong also closed down today. The Senate is looking to ban the sale of tickets to the presidential inauguration. California's Dianne Feinstein introduced the bill yesterday in the Senate. The bill would punish scalpers with up to a $100,000 fine or a year in prison. eBay has already halted ticket sales, with some going for over $7,000.
Wow.
Some residents are returning home after fires destroyed nearly 1,000 homes in apartments in Southern California. Only one fire has been fully contained, but calm winds and clear skies have helped firefighters make progress. Officials say at least one of the fires was caused by humans. And there's more snow on the way for the Great Lakes region. Michigan's Upper Peninsula and southeastern Michigan should expect the heaviest snow from the lake effect.
Thanks very much, Mark. Snow, yikes.
Lower by the lake.
Catherine Lanfer is in for John Hockenberry. Good morning, Catherine.
Hey.
And we're going to move to Arizona, where authorities in Phoenix say Mexico's violent drug war has jumped the border. The number of violent kidnappings in the city and the surrounding area has spiked, with 266 reported kidnappings, according to an investigation by CBS News. That number actually could be three times as high, say, reportedly, because so many of these kidnappings go unreported. And officials say most of those kidnapped and held for ransoms of up to $1 million are part of the criminal underworld themselves. For more on the story, we go now to Mark Moran, the news director of KJZZ in Phoenix. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
So explain to us what law enforcement officials are saying is happening.
Well, it's complicated. I mean, for years, Phoenix has been kind of a hotbed of smuggling. In the old days, it used to be a kind of a nod and a wink in terms of illegal immigrants being smuggled across the border by smugglers known here as coyotes, who take money once you're smuggled across the border, and you go off and do your thing if you're an immigrant coming in undocumented, and the coyotes go back across the border and bring their next load. Well, as the border security has tightened in Phoenix and Texas and other border states, it's gotten a lot harder to smuggle not only people, but drugs across the border. So obviously the stakes are higher, the prices are higher, the level of danger goes way up. And what you have evolving is a turf war among these coyotes or these smugglers who say, well, this is my route. This is where I smuggle my immigrants, or this is where I smuggle my drugs. And to prove it, if you try to get onto my turf, I'm going to kill you, or I'm going to kidnap members of your family. It goes beyond that, too, in terms of just the level of money involved.
The numbers here are shocking. 266 reported kidnappings in Phoenix, and that's just the reported number.
Right. The number is, don't pay any attention to the numbers. It's sort of like the guy behind the curtain. You never really know how many bodies are out in the desert. You don't know. And the police will tell you that kind of off the record. We don't know how bad this problem is, but we know it's a bad problem because we've got specific task forces designed to deal specifically with it. But to give you an idea of how serious these guys are about their turf, there was one instance, and there's been instances all over the country actually now, some of these drug cartels, but they will... You'll be a known smuggler, and there'll be another smuggler who knows who you are, and maybe he'll decide that he wants this turf badly enough, or just wants your cash badly enough that you've gotten from the people that you've smuggled, the drugs that you've sold, that someone from his gang will kidnap a family member of the other guy's gang or cartel and demand ransom of up to $1 million. And so it's whether or not they actually have the person or not, there's also these virtual kidnappings where they'll call and say, hey, I've got your wife here. No, I'm not going to put her on the phone. You're going to have to believe me, and I'm going to kill her if you don't give me $500,000, and you know where to meet me. So there is no border in this drug war anymore. It's just sort of a region. But it's very serious, and the stakes are very high, and so are the dollars.
Mark, is it fair to say this is spilling over from Mexico, where they have seen a skyrocketing murder rate? Over 3,000 people have been killed there this year, and they're attributing it to these drug gangs fighting over control of smuggling routes into California, Arizona, and Texas. Is it all part of the same thing?
It is. It's all part of the same thing. And, you know, like I said before, it used to just be people and, you know, you'd smuggle across 15 or 20 people and they'd go on their way and you'd take your $1,000 or whatever it was as a smuggler. But as the border has become tightened, the stakes are higher. And, yeah, it's just a full-blown turf war, and the stakes are now – it's not just drugs and people either. There's also guns that get smuggled across the border, and they're very serious about defending their turf, serious enough to kill people, to hold them up for their money, and to abduct family members as well.
If we can't go by the numbers, how do we know that it's gotten worse?
Well, because the police are saying, you know, they're busier than ever with this. There are certain ways you can tell just by, you know, when you interview somebody, you can see the look on their face, and this is an epidemic. I mean, this has been several years ago now. I went out into the desert off of Interstate 10, and not very far off of Interstate 10 either. That was a kind of a prime dumping ground for people who would be killed and dumped in the desert. And we had a spate here where there was 2 and 3 a week, which had never happened before. And that's just one little area off of Interstate 10 that the police happen to know about and were willing to talk about. You just get a feel. I know it's not a good answer to say, well, I can't say there's 25 now and 150 this week, but you get a feel when something is bad from the police, even if they're not going to give you specific numbers about how bad things are. You can just kind of tell, if you will.
Mark, it sounds like some of these incidences are incredibly bold, snatching people from malls, running people off the side of the road in their cars. Is this something that you see out in the open, or for the most part, what you're reporting to us, is this happening under the radar?
It's very much under the radar. I mean, there are places in every city that you don't want to go, but it's not like I can take you down to a part of Phoenix and say, look at that guy, he's a smuggler, or look at that guy, he's working for a smuggler. Obviously, you can drive around street corners now almost any place in America and tell who illegal immigrants are who've been brought across and just want a job, looking for work. But it's very complex. And I want to go back to something you said a second ago about how bold some of these crimes are. There was a teenage girl standing out in front of a house in South Phoenix. The house was believed to be that of a drug smuggler. And they knew that this drug smuggler had family and had teenage kids. Well, somebody from a rival cartel pulled up in a car, snatched this girl, threw her in the back of the car, drove away, called the guy and said, hey, we've got your daughter, and we're going to kill her if we don't get X number of dollars. as it turned out, the girl was not even related to that family member, and in one way or another, she wound up being freed unharmed. But you mentioned bold. That's about as bold as it gets. I think she was 13 or 14 years old and was not even related to them. They just assumed that she was, and they snatched her.
What kind of impact is this going to have on people who aren't involved in this? Do you have people, literally other shoppers at malls, other people standing around in neighborhoods who are also at risk?
I don't think so. I mean, the parts of town and the parts of the city of Phoenix where this typically happens, I don't spend a lot of time in parts of Phoenix where there are a lot of gangs. But just from what I've heard and from people I've talked to, people on our Latino Affairs desk have not said that it's a huge problem where you have to be afraid to go to the mall. Generally, people who are involved in this and their family members tend to know it, unless you're an innocent 13-year-old girl standing in front of somebody's house who happens to be a smuggler. I don't want to say the danger rate has gone through the roof and people are looking over their shoulders at shopping malls and things like that. I wouldn't say that's happening.
Mark, last question for you. What is law enforcement doing, and is it some kind of joint task force where you're talking about both state, local, and federal officers or detectives are involved?
Everybody's involved, even into the ICE. The Customs Enforcement Bureau is involved in this, as well as local police. But they can only do so much. It's kind of like enforcing the border laws. I mean, if you have smugglers who are willing to smuggle people across for a certain number of dollars, and the higher that price goes, the more risks they're willing to take. I mean, Border Patrol agents will tell you it's hard to defend the border. It really is. And it's hard to hire Border Patrol agents for what they get paid. But I guess back to your original question, yes, everyone is involved in this, right down to local police. The Maricopa County Sheriff here, whom you all know as Sheriff Joe, who's supposedly the quote-unquote toughest sheriff in America, is very involved, at least talking about trying to slow illegal immigrants, but also trying to stop this drug trafficking. And he has actually reached out to local law enforcement agencies, Phoenix police, suburban police around Phoenix, to really try to crack down and to give them the authority to do usually what the county sheriff would, which is to try to make arrests when they see things happening and to try to slow this down. But it's very difficult. Frankly, the police are outmanned in some instances. The smugglers who are coming across are using more sophisticated weapons than the police have. So it's a very difficult challenge.
Mark Moran, many thanks for that report.
You're welcome.
Mark Moran is the news director for KJZZ, and he joined us from Phoenix.
I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry. You know, we're always on here at The Takeaway. Now, the government's financial bailout plan is topic number one on Capitol Hill today. And the big three automakers are pleading for money. It's all coming to a head. Where would you like to see that money go? Let us know. 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. Here's today's Takeaway.
The way that the transition is operating so far is entirely consistent with how he has run the campaign. And that is just calm and deliberate, with the exception of the Hillary Clinton potential appointment.
That Chicago Sun-Times, Lynn Sweet. Take our podcast to go every morning. If you missed anything, you can subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes. I'm Dora Udoji.
I'm Catherine Lanfer. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Oh, it's such a silly thing.